In today's show, we have Benno Dunkelsbühler, who is Chief Sherpa at Realign Expansion Sherpas in Cincinnati, Ohio. I met Benno a few years ago at ACG Cincinnati, and today on the show, we're going to talk about growth at the intersection of innovation and execution in consumer products.
If you're ready to learn how technology is driving business innovation in Cincinnati and beyond, you're tuned in to the right podcast. Join us for interviews and discussions with business leaders, innovators, and visionaries. With our host, Sam Schulte, CEO of Unstoppable Software. This is Unstoppable Talk.
Okay, Benno, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So maybe a good place for us to start is, how did you get started? How did you get into this field? What's your background?
Sure, I got into, I got my start really in the business world after college, spending 10 years on the retail side, working for big retailers like IKEA and Pottery Barn as marketing manager, as buyer. And from there, I went to the wholesale side, distribution side of the business, and spent 10 years essentially on the selling side of the desk instead of the buying side of the desk, as head merchant and then general manager and CEO of big distributors. And then 10 years ago, started my own company, and we put teams together to help companies expand into new channels, new categories, or grow in their core channels and categories with a better go-to-market process.
Okay, interesting. And you primarily focus on which industries?
The process that we use to help companies grow is really industry agnostic, but the people, the Sherpas, we ourselves are not industry agnostic. So because my background is in consumer products, we tend to get projects in the consumer industry, factories or distributors that are selling either through e-commerce, direct to consumer, or to retailers in a B2B environment.
Okay. And what was kind of the first real game-changing project you did in the space that kind of allowed you to take off in the arena?
You know, it would have been way back when I was a buyer on the buying side of the equation, and I was given a challenge to develop a residential lamp for a residential lamp program for Pottery Barn. And the idea behind it was pretty revolutionary, crazy, innovative, whatever term you want to use. But the idea was to take a glass beaded lamp shade that was available, only made in Italy at the time, and sold at like $800-$900 retail. I was being challenged with developing a similar glass beaded lampshade program out of India at 1/10 that price, 1/20 that price, actually, at like $29-$49 type of price point. And the complexity of working the design angle, working the sourcing angle, working the international logistics angle of combining manufacturing overseas for the lampshade with with U.S. manufacturing for the lamp base, and putting that all together was a hair-raising experience, but a fascinating experience that ended up being this multi-million-dollar success story. So that was really, you know, I don't know if that was my first break, but that was just a big success story that happened when I was fairly young, and that gave me the confidence to take challenging projects that other people sort of run away from, because they seem to be too complex or too unconventional. And, you know, I love those types of projects. And, you know, we've done projects that clients have given us in the last 10 years since I started Realign that the internal team just maybe doesn't have the bandwidth to figure out. It's not necessarily that they're so complex, they're like brain surgery, NASA type of complexity. But the internal team usually doesn't have the bandwidth to figure them out. Mm-hmm. So we help them, we help our clients figure out those kinds of category development, channel development, go-to-market process development challenges, and create multi-million dollar successes for the clients.
So I'm curious with that particular project with India and the U.S. So why would they do the lampshade in India and then the base in the U.S.? I mean, if you're going to do one piece over there, why not do it all over there?
Basically, different countries are very good at different things. India is very good at handicraft. The lampshade hat, you know, there's no way that a machine could make that kind of lampshade product. Mm-hmm. But the lamp base has wiring, has UL listed parts. If you don't machine those parts, you're setting people's houses on fire.
Yeah.
So you know, there, at least at that time, lamp bases were typically made in U.S. manufacturing plants.
So is that a lot of the, on a lot of the projects you get involved with, you're sort of trying to come up with a strategy for building different pieces sort of from international suppliers? Is that a common pattern that for things you're working on based on their strength, you know, based on each country's strengths? Is that something that happens
at times,
a lot?
I mean, they're the more product related a project is, the more you end up looking at manufacturing strengths within different countries or within the United States as well. But many of our growth challenges are not necessarily product related. They're oftentimes just taking the same product but into a new channel. You know, we have a distributor that is very, you know, does hundreds of millions of dollars of distribution into brick and mortar stores. And they had not figured out how to sell in e-commerce without competing against the brick and mortar stores. So that was a growth project where we had to, that had nothing to do with product development or product manufacturing. It was all about channel distribution, channel idiosyncrasies, and coming up with an omni-channel distribution strategy.
So that's an interesting question. So in general, how do brick and mortars keep from competing against themselves when they open on e-commerce? Are there some best practices there, or does it really depend on what they're selling?
Depends on what they're selling. It depends on whether they're selling branded product or unbranded product. It depends on whether, so in this particular project that I'm thinking of, the distributor was selling unbranded product to the brick and mortar retailer, usually under the Target brand or the Walmart brand, the house brand, right? Private labeled. So we came up with a different private label name for selling similar product online.
Okay, interesting. Kind of make it so it's exclusive, so you can only get it there type thing.
Exactly. Gotcha. Exactly.
Interesting. So in this sort of consumer products industry, you know, what are some of the key drivers and pressures that are affecting your customers that are sort of forcing them to want to talk to you or causing them to want to talk to you to achieve expansion? I mean, what are some of those pressures they're under?
I think a couple different pressures. One pressure is just the sort of ubiquity of product availability. I call it the democratization of design, right? It used to be that designing a product, distributors or factories that knew how to design a product ended up owning that niche. And design has become more ubiquitous. There's more access to designing products. Technology has allowed factories to knock off each other's product designs, right? So we help. So one of the ways that we help clients is to differentiate their particular package, which includes the product design, the product price, the service, you know, the whole go-to-market formula. We help them differentiate that go-to-market process to be more effective than their competitor.
So maybe we can, when we talk about product design, I guess, can you clarify for those of us that aren't working exactly in that space, when we're talking about design, I mean, are you just talking about the colors and look and feel of, say, a lamp? Do you look at it, or is it from a user interface perspective?
I mean, it's all of the all above, that. Right? I mean, design is, you know, there's product design, which is the look and feel and color and shape and size, right? That's sort of traditional product design. Then there's an engineering component where oftentimes you have to engineer to a price point if you want to sell something for $19.99. And the designer thinks it should be gold-plated, it's probably not going to be $19.99, right?
Yeah.
So you have to reverse engineer for it to maybe look like but isn't. You have to, you know, packaging is part of the design process. Whether the, think of Apple products, the way, you know, when you go to an Apple store, the way that is packaged is part of the buying experience and you know, of how we think about Apple.
Yeah.
The design is part of it. And then user, you know, usability and user interface is part of the design process. So there's a ton of different aspects to product design.
And I guess you get into, you know, cloud services and apps and other things sometimes too, especially I've seen more and more companies doing all kinds of products that are, you know, IoT enabled and stuff, for instance, you know, that's part of the feature set maybe. So
right.
Pretty broad, broad topic to it, I guess. So I think another thing that's interesting about the way that your business operates is, you know, so your title is Chief Sherpa.
Right.
And the name of the name of the company is Realign Expansion Sherpas. So talk about that term, Sherpas, because maybe not everybody uses that term in other industries. And what is, how does that reflect how you engage and why that's different and better for your customers?
So I started the business 10 years ago, basically hanging my name, you know, hanging out my shingle as a consultant. And I realized pretty quickly that, you know, in 2009, when I started the business, right after the Great Recession, the world had gained, or the United States had gained, I don't know, we had rampant, you know, 10, 12% unemployment. So there were, I don't know, 10 million unemployed people. So so we had gained like 9 million consultants that year, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning the term consultant is completely overused. And in fact, is not people, most consultants, even professional consultants, not just people between jobs, but professional consultants don't typically focus on execution. They typically, you know, I make fun of the consulting world by saying they're people who tell you what you already knew using bigger words,
right.
Putting it on a pretty PowerPoint, and then they walk away after leaving a 5 or 6 figure invoice. So I use the word Sherpa to express that we are really serious about execution, right? What we help our clients, you know, we help our clients reach new mountaintops of new channels of distribution, new categories of product, better go to market. You know, that's like reaching new mountaintops. You would never take a consultant on a trip up Mount Everest.
Sure.
You would take a Sherpa who is an experienced, trusted guide who carries the backpack, pitches the tent, makes coffee in the morning, and makes sure that you get to the mountaintop. So that's really how we approach our work with clients. It is side by side, sort of mano a mano. And when I use the word Sherpa, people usually, you know, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Or it begets that the question you just asked me, and then you're like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I think largely that's the way we work too. Mm-hmm. And you're right that, you know, in our space, probably 90% of quote unquote consultants are really just sort of not an employee who's, you know, a staff aug type position, you know, short term, 6 month contract thing. I mean, they're just kind of, it's another way to avoid a W-2 or something, right?
Right.
In a way. And then there's other folks out there that we certainly know tons that they just kind of come in and tell you about their framework and their system, and then they leave you, like you said, a blueprint or a roadmap or whatever, and good luck, right? So I think it is pretty cool and really so much more effective when you really get into their environment and work on it with them, because otherwise, you know, you can't assess anything short term to know that you're even giving good advice, right?
And you certainly can't execute it within 3 months,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So our projects tend to be 2 or 3 year projects,
yeah.
Where, you know, we go from concepting to writing the roadmap, mm-hmm. to aligning all the pieces of the roadmap, right? To make sure that the product and the people and the channels and the go-to-market strategy is aligned, mm-hmm. and executed. And, you know, it usually takes at least a year to have $2 million worth of revenue flowing in from those ideas. And mm-hmm. then it takes another year for that to be, you know, a multiple of that.
Yeah. Well, I'd imagine you spend a lot of time as a teacher as part of those engagements too, because, you know, potentially because, you know, like we said, if someone puts together a PowerPoint, a consultant, and says, do things this way, well, that doesn't change the customer's ability to execute right. on it, but you have to gradually help them improve, help them implement those things so that 2-3 years later, yeah. it's set, they know how to do it now.
We do a fair amount of workshops with yeah. clients where we'll do a couple hour meetings, a number of, you know, weekly meetings for a couple months, or, you know, 2 day offsite mm-hmm. training sessions.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, you know, if your projects are 2 or 3 years in length, mm-hmm. so do you typically do one engagement at a time that's taking all of your attention for three solid years, or how do you split that up so that you're not sort of so much ebb and flow?
We usually have plus or minus a handful of projects going on at the same time. You know, there's a group of us. Mm-hmm. All of our Sherpas are contractors to sort of stay in the hunt and hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them are in a place in their or mid or late career folks that, you know, they're perfectly happy working 20 hours a week, 30 hours a week on 1 or 2 projects. Mm-hmm. Others are eager to work 50 and 80 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to solve the traditional consulting model challenge of ebb and flow,
mm-hmm.
With a contractor Sherpa model.
Gotcha.
That allows us to have fairly even flow of projects.
And we've talked before about some of the model you try to do with that is sort of as if, you know, like you're a startup living within the enterprise. Is that something you still kind of...
Yeah, it is. I mean, our projects essentially are internal startups,
yeah.
right? We work with mid-sized businesses that are typically, you know, I would say our sweet spot is somewhere between, you know, north of $5 million of revenue and south of $200 million, you know, between $5 and $200 million of annual revenue. We've had clients that were outside on either side of that spectrum, but those types of, you know, mid-sized distributors, mid-sized factories are in need of somebody to help with the internal startup of an idea and executing it, right? It's not just about, hey, let's do an innovation workshop and use really cool language for 2 days mm-hmm. and then write a 3-inch binder and put it on a shelf.
Sure.
but let's create an internal startup where a Sherpa is being put in charge of making sure that the people and the processes are sort of everybody's aligned, and we work towards getting it done.
And I'm curious, when you look at factories and distributors, you know, that particular space, you know, are there certain sort of go-to-market projects that you kind of find you're doing, you know, not the same thing over and over and over again, but is there a certain thing that everybody is sort of moving into? Like, is everyone wanting to get into e-commerce, or, you know, are there certain major patterns that people are the real sort of places are getting the highest ROI by growing into? Or is it all just, is every project completely different?
I think the red thread, right? Mm-hmm. The commonality between all our projects is that our client, the owner, the CEO, top executive of a company, is eager to grow faster, but is, you know, hit some kind of growth ceiling. And so we help them break through that growth ceiling, whether that is through e-commerce or through a new product or through just changing the current go-to-market process to a more effective go-to-market process. I would say the common thread is they're looking for growth, and we can do it one of three ways, right? New channel, new category, or core channel category, but better go-to-market process.
Let's take a quick break. This podcast is sponsored by Unstoppable Software, a Cincinnati-based technology consulting firm. At Unstoppable Software, we bolt on to your company's team and accelerate their ability to deliver custom software development projects. With our deep experience in manufacturing, engineering, and healthcare, we can tailor systems for process improvement, data analytics, machine learning, and document workflow so they become a user-friendly, perfect fit for your employees and the way they want to work. To learn more about how we make our clients unstoppable, visit us at unstoppablesoftware.com or call us at 513-382-8499. And now, back to Unstoppable Talk.
Interesting. So it sounds like it's kind of an interesting concept that anybody making products in a consumer space, I mean, things are not infinitely scalable, right? So, I mean, eventually, the way they've been doing things that took them from, say, 2 million to 50 million,
right,
they're going to hit a ceiling, potentially, and they're going to need to make some major change either to drastically cut what it costs to build these things or make new products, mm-hmm, or find a new channel because they've saturated and they can only sell so many at Walmart, let's say.
Right.
Like Walmart is selling as much as they possibly can for them.
Yep.
What's next? Because otherwise, yep, they're going to stick right at 50 million. So that's the type of thing those are some ceilings you help break through, I guess.
Exactly. So, we help companies break those glass ceilings or growth ceilings. And you know, the real problem that we solve the real problem is that you cannot run even the most talented executive on this planet cannot run a business and build a new business at the same time with the same resources, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a universal truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the reason why companies hit a growth ceiling, because everybody on the team, even the most talented executives, are working however many hours, 40 or 80 hours a week, fully engaged in running that business. Mm-hmm. And when you're fully engaged in running that business, you don't have the bandwidth,
mm-hmm,
to build a new channel, build a new category, or a better go-to-market process for the core channel and category. So you need some resource. In our case, an outside resource of Sherpas that comes in and figures out that problem of what does it take to build that new business while the core business is continued to be run.
It's like, you know, there's always the advice that entrepreneurs get to working on versus working in the business. And I guess that sounds like it applies to even much larger firms. Probably gets worse, the larger you are, right?
You need to, we help them work on the business while they're working in the business, but then we're also working in that new business.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So when you're engaged on projects like this, where do these run into challenges? I mean, where do these sort of engagements struggle? Where, you know, what are some of the hangups on the, you know, obviously not everything goes flawlessly all the time.
So I wish.
What are some of the main walls you run into, I guess, on these?
I think buy-in and resources are sort of common challenges that we run into, right? Buy-in from the core team working on the core business, they need to be, you know, we need to make sure that they're bought into the fact that they're excited about, that they believe in this new business, this new adjacent category or adjacent distribution channel that we're building for them, that they're bought into the fact that, oh my God, these Sherpas are building that for us. They're getting it from zero to something, zero to, let's say, zero to $10 million, whatever the number is, so that when it reaches a threshold, the Sherpas will turn it over to the core team, and the core team will be excited about running with that business, right? So buy-in is an important, is something that we're always challenging ourselves with, make sure that we have buy-in for what we're doing, because without it, resources end up drying up. Right?
People get pulled off on other things.
People get busy and people lose patience. So project momentum is hugely important. When we say, you know, when we help a company enter this in one of these three ways, grow, and we say, we believe there is a $20 million revenue opportunity to be had within X time frame, we got to make sure we hit those revenue numbers by the time frame. And if we don't, the project loses momentum, loses credibility, and resources will get pulled.
Interesting. So, and where does technology touch these projects? You know, is it, you know, what sort of tools do you use a lot of software tools to track that sort of return, or you know, I imagine there's a lot of manufacturing technology that you could come in and implement in order to be able to make certain new types of products, or
so our clients have technologies, obviously, in the manufacturing space, be it, you know, robots or CNC machinery or what have you, that have a tremendous impact on the costing and efficiency of manufacturing. On our side of the equation, communication technology is the big, you know, is what keeps me up at night. You know, when I started this business 10 years ago, just having an email account and a phone line that could let you make, you know, free phone calls to China was, that was pretty cool 10 years ago. And now it's about communication, you know, now it's about online collaboration and platforms, whether that be, you know, simple things like WeChat and WhatsApp or Trello or Slack or, you know, we use Office 365, SharePoint and Team. To communicate between the Sherpas and Sherpa to client, and it just in the last 6 months, we've spent a lot of time improving the way we are what we call memorializing the journey,
mm-hmm.
right? When we're on a 2 or 3 year project, you know, everybody knows in the first 3 months, oh, yeah, I know what they're doing. But then 6, 12 months into it, they're like, you know, the client, you know, certain people on the client team might be like, okay, what exactly are they working on again? So having SharePoint as a way, you know, where we can create folders and give access to the client team so that it doesn't just sit in somebody's email inbox and somebody's hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the old, oh, yeah, I sent that to you 3 months ago.
Right.
No, it sits on, you know, on SharePoint. They have access to it. And so online collaboration is, you know, changing rapidly, obviously, and as an important tool, really for any kind of off-site collaboration.
Mm-hmm. And are most of your team members sort of remote? All over the place?
All of them remote. You know, we have clients here in Cincinnati. We have clients in other states. We have clients in Asia, in China, mm-hmm. in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
In Europe as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so especially, you know, you definitely have to rely on all those different portal technologies and whatnot just to share information because,
right.
you know, you're not going to be able to do it in real time all the time, so, you know, if you're spread across like that. I'm curious too, you were talking about being able to sort of keep people on the pulse of change for a project and mm-hmm. you know, up to speed with the information that's out there. When you're dealing with that long term of a project, how do you handle, you know, turnover within a customer too? Because we've run into issues before where, you know, we're 12 months into a 24-month thing and the main stakeholder leaves and you're like...
Right.
Oh,
dang, we're starting from scratch.
And they're like, "What? Tell me about what is this project we're doing that
right.
we hired you for?"
Right.
So, you know, do you run into that often or?
I'm just remembering one project four or five years ago where the president, the division president of the client's company retired halfway through the project, and a new division president came in who mm-hmm. asked exactly what you just asked, or what you just said. Mm-hmm. Well, what's this all about, and why do you do it this way? And we're like, well, we're halfway done, and okay, so now we're questioning all the base assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, the biggest tool I used in that case 4 or 5 years ago was just diplomatic collaboration,
mm-hmm.
right? Figuring out how to get the new president comfortable with where we were, and we had to make some, you know, we had to negotiate some changes
mm-hmm.
Because she was coming from a different place, and that's her right.
Yeah.
Today we have an additional tool which is this online collaboration. It makes it easier for me to bring a new division president or a new director of, or vice president who just started last week. It's easier to bring them into this get them up to speed on the project when you have an easy way of file sharing
mm-hmm.
that is organized in a logical way. You're not just doing a data dump of 92 different Excel sheets and Word documents and PowerPoints, mm-hmm. but you're giving them access to 4 different folders that are, you know, or let's say 3 different folders that are sort of named beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
and that makes turnover easier to manage.
I think you're right that it certainly takes a lot of diplomacy. I mean, that's a good word. I mean, it's, you know, it's...
Marriage takes diplomacy, so does this.
Sure. Yeah, and I think, you know, what I find, especially high-level executives that enter in, you know, they don't want... So if you're working on a project that was like mainstay banner project for their predecessor,
right.
On one hand, if you're like, look, you spent millions of dollars and you want to pull the plug, like, How can they justify that? Mm-hmm. But then you're almost twisting their arm a bit, like, right. You have to keep us, right?
Right.
And they're, you know, there's no real motivation to them to glorify their predecessor or to make the predecessor look good.
Right.
So
right.
Can you put it now, can you get it under their wheelhouse that makes them look good?
That's right.
And on the other hand, you know, obviously any executive that comes in has their sort of own background and history of the way they want to do things, it changes, and they want to make an impact, right? They don't want to just be like, seem like an interim person that's just right. maintaining the status quo. So I think if you, probably some of it is just the professionalism by which you engage them and not twist their arm.
Right.
And make it like, okay, well, how do we need to change this project so it fits with your goals, right?
And you're absolutely right. And, you know, when I describe the ideal Sherpa to be involved in projects like this, for Sherpas that are project leaders, we're looking for people that have 20, 30 years of experience. So it's not just about project management and visibility and accountability, but it is also about doing that in a diplomatic and comfortable and organic way.
Mm-hmm.
That helps us to manage change, because, you know, what we're doing is change management, but it's not change management and the sort of, hey, let's have a half day workshop on change management, mm-hmm. put it in a binder and check the box.
Right.
But, you know, it's, you know, we're helping companies either create growth or manage growth. And that's the kind of change management,
Gotcha. And I imagine then that there's certain clients or not clients, but prospects or opportunities that approach you that that are not a good fit. I mean, so, you know, what are how do you select the projects that you want to work on? What are the, you know, what are you really sort of looking to do next, I guess?
You know, I sort of joke about the fact that there's probably 1,000 companies that need us, but only 10 that want us. And so that's the first differentiation between a good prospect and just a prospect. Is their willingness to accept help, their openness to an outside perspective, you know, them being excited about an outside perspective. And then outside of that, the sort of filter we use for potential prospects is, do we think we can add at least $3 million worth of revenue that we can hang our hat on within 24 months?
Mm-hmm.
And we've done, you know, we've done much more than that. But if we can't, you know, if it's less than that, it becomes difficult. It becomes less interesting for the client.
Yeah.
It becomes less interesting for us. So that's sort of one of the filters we use. Can we add at least $2 or $3 million worth of revenue within?
Interesting. So that's a pretty repeatable process that you're like, you know, $3 million over 24 months. I can either say thumbs up or thumbs down if I think I can do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You so know, then,
and I imagine that it kind of lines up with whatever ROI they're getting from it, and what they're paying, and all that too.
You know? Exactly. And when I said earlier, our sweet spot is, you know, north of $5 million. That's, it so happens that 50% of $5 million is $2 or $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
So if I,
that's pretty drastic growth for a $3 million.
That would
company.
Be that, you know, 50% growth within 24 months is drastic.
Yeah.
So it becomes you know, and which is why for, you know, $100-200 million companies we've done $10 and $20 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at least getting $2 or $3 million within 24 months is important. Then we can apply the resource intensity that gets that, and the client can get an ROI on what they're paying for the resource, that it makes it interesting for them.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, that's, you know, if even if you're a $20 million company, adding 10-15% to your revenues is a big deal.
Can be a big deal.
You know, in 2 years, so.
Yeah.
What do you think the most personally rewarding project recently that you've worked on has been? Just what you've, what's really connected with you, you've enjoyed?
You know, it comes down to people in the end. It's there's one client, actually, right down the road here, Daniel Gigi at Down Decor, who has been a client for almost 4 years now, and we have been able to build a mutual trust relationship and a, you know, almost brotherly call each other out, what I call healthy tension kind of relationship that produces magical results, right? When you have that rapport with a client and vice versa, they with you, then you don't spend time watching your back. You're just putting all of your eyes, you know, your vision forward, not backwards. And we together, we tripled the size of his business in the last 3.5 years. Wow. That's tremendously rewarding for him. It's tremendous. It's fun. Because that's a game changer. Right. His business today, you know, he just added a 20,000 square foot building to his manufacturing plant. He's got 90 employees where he used to have 50, but he's, you know, he not even doubled the number of employees, but more than tripled his revenue. So do the, you know,
What are his products that he sells?
It's a basic bedding. They make all the white boring stuff that's between the sheets. Pillow inserts and comforters and a beautiful, high quality, downfilled, not Walmart quality.
Interesting. No, I mean, I think that's, you know, rewarding all around when something is a hit like that and you have a big success. For sure.
Nothing succeeds like success, right?
Well, and it's fun. It makes it fun to come in every day and think up new ideas. And of course, you get a lot more free reign, I imagine, to try new things and whatever when you're, you know, when you're trusted like that. What do you think are some of the sweet spots outside of some of the industries we've been talking about in terms of consumer products? That, you know, what are some industries that are maybe you've done less in, but you're starting to get people wanting to get your help in?
So we are venturing from an industry perspective, and then from a functional perspective. From an industry perspective, we're venturing outside of that sort of traditional consumer product space. We just did a growth evaluation for a construction product company. They make countertops. It's a countertop fabricator. So they're selling to general contractors and millwork and casework manufacturers. So that's a new vertical that we're getting into, and that's fun because it's sort of proof of concept for what I said earlier. You know, the approach is industry agnostic, but the Sherpa is not. And then from a functional sweet spot, sort of outside of the traditional business building category, channel, go to market process. I would have to say organizational development, because we end up working closely with certain departments, certain individuals on the client team, even if we only work with them, you know, every other week for an hour. We're sort of, you know, they're lending us a resource, but we end up getting a close look at what works, what doesn't work in different departments. And that invariably leads to somebody like me will have an opinion on, you know, this department could maybe be run better with if you changed this process, or maybe a person needs to be more willing, open to change. Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's, so I, when you, you know, I guess when you say organizational development, you're, that's almost like rather than entering a new market, a new channel, a new product, which is sort of the typical three big things I think you're doing, right?
Yep.
That's the markets they're already in, the products they already have, the channels already in, just trying to make them work better and sort of be and run better, I guess. Is that something where you're, you know, are you looking at coming in doing, you know, lean and agile and you know, Six Sigma and these sorts of things to help in that regard, or is it more managerial type skills?
It's, it is, sometimes it's just organizational, looking at the organizational chart and looking at should this work be done by three departments or seven departments, right? Are there redundancies? Are two departments doing the exact same thing? That type of question. So when when we look at organizational charts, sometimes it's looking at job descriptions. Do you have the right people on the right seats of the bus? And sometimes it's training sessions. I'll give a quick example. We had a factory that had a 20-person team that was basically doing product engineering and product quoting with the customer. And three good people probably could have done the work of the 20 people. This was a 20-person department in Vietnam where labor rates are so much lower that the pressure... That would have never happened in a high-wage country. But we ended up doing several days' worth of workshops and then follow-up with video call training over a number of months to teach the team how to simply know who's on first and what's on second. You know, we did race. We called it a racy shop. Racy is a, you can Google racy, R-A-C-I. R stands for who is responsible, A stands for who is accountable, C for who is to be consulted, asked, and I is who is to be informed. So those are different levels of involvement between being accountable and responsible and asked and informed. That, you know, we gave them our suggestion, or actually we worked on who should do what within those four letters on each project. And that in itself ended up being an eye-opener for that client, for that team, that not everybody needs to know about everything, because when everybody thinks they need to know everything, nobody knows nothing. Because
nobody can absorb everything.
Because nobody can absorb everything, and you need to have the right people absorbing the right things. And you probably don't need the owner to make every decision. But you probably need the owner to be informed on everything. And maybe even consulted on most things. But not to be doing everything.
That's interesting.
Right.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I imagine if you come into if you come into a customer that is, I don't know, a few hundred people, and they're not, and they're nowhere near as sort of lean and mean as your internal startup team is. It's interesting the sort of like cultural and process differences between that. I mean, there must be some a wide gulf between the way things are run. You know, and so if you can go back and instead of, you know, and basically re-engineer the old stuff. I mean, again, that's a, I'm sure, a whole other sort of level of service and market for you. But it, it would be interesting. I was involved in a startup years ago that was basically just an internal subsidiary of a large insurance carrier. And so it was this fun, you know, it grew from six people to 80 people in one year. But it was this fun, you know, upbeat .com type thing within this, you know, 10,000 employee
stodgy
sort of stodgy insurance company. And of course, I mean, they all thought we were from another planet.
Because you were.
You know, so I imagine you run into that. How do, we, how, you know, do you have to deal with that sort of like
all the time.
People fighting to want to, well, I want to be on the fun team, right? Or something like that. Or
I mean, there are, I think one of the reasons I love doing what I do is because I grew up in Germany. I came to the States when I was 16. I ended up, you know, I've sort of spent my whole life being not from around here, right? And that applies to the way I work,
yeah,
right? I go into a client's business and I'm not from around there, right? And our Sherpas work, have worked in a whole number of different companies as an employee and now as a Sherpa. And that gives us an outside perspective, sort of that fresh outside perspective when we walk into a client, and it allows us to just sort of point out that, hey, you're all speaking Greek over here and you're all speaking Chinese over there.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we try something different? So it is, you know, companies are filled with little subcultures.
Yeah.
You know, the accounting department is usually a different subculture from the product development department,
mm-hmm.
right? And the sales department is another subculture yet again. And some of that is okay for making that function work.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that, you know, can be made better by learning another language and translating between the different cultures and giving them a common language to, okay, so you're an accountant and I'm a product engineer, so we do different things. One is from Mars and one is from Venus type of thing, right? And that's okay. But how do you bring mutual respect into that, you know? And that's where, when I talk about organizational development, helping clients, you know, I love helping create those aha moments where they look, you know, we look at their org chart or we look at their processes together and I'm asking a couple questions and they're like, yeah, okay, I see where you're going. Got it. Yeah. Check.
Well, and it's interesting. I've thought before about, you know, like, I think to be truly great as a, you know, let's say as a consultant, but as an outsider coming into another company that to help them, you know, it does sort of get baked into your DNA a little bit in term, because you have to have had such a sort of diverse path maybe in some ways. Like, you know, if you were born in Cincinnati and worked for 35 years at one company and then said, okay, now I'm going to go out and do what you do now, it'd be much harder. But since, you know, like you said, you're sort of an outsider, have always sort of felt that way, you probably are, I would imagine, you hear a lot of the same things over and over again from a lot of different people, different companies, right? I mean, that's what I always sort of find. It's like, it's rare that I hear something really new or like, oh, I've never heard that before. You know, it's always the same problems. Most of the time, they're people problems, right?
Or process.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a
or lack of vision.
there's a book I love called The Secrets of Consulting, and his number one law, I think it is no matter what anyone tells you, it's always a people problem. Like all problems, doesn't matter, right? Stem from people. But yeah, you have to have an interesting background, I think, to be able to come in and do what you do, you know, for
companies. Gotta be open-minded, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, have vision. So primarily, if folks are out there listening, I guess just to summarize, you know, if they're manufacturing a product, if they're distributing a product currently, the main problems that you can help them with that they should reach out to you are
growth. Right. The main problem that we solve for companies is you cannot run a business and build a business at the same time with the same resources. And if you hit a growth ceiling, we can help you break through that growth ceiling and change the way you think about your business in some cases by reaching another mountaintop.
Very cool. And what's your website?
Realignforresults.com.
Very cool. And do you want to give your phone number or email address maybe to, if folks want to reach out to you?
Sure. You can reach me at Benno@realignforresults.com. Or give me a call at 513-407-5436.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Benno. I always enjoy our in-depth analytical conversations around, you know, these sort of business challenges. I find so much of it applies even to my business. We're nowhere near the size of your typical client, but everyone faces some of the same challenges and has blinders, you know, to opportunities. So
this was fun. This was fun. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem.
I always enjoy it as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.